In the matter of Officer Gregory DiGuglielmo and NJIT, may we please have appearances of counsel?
May it please the court, Joshua Forsman, Caruso Smith Pacini, on behalf of Plaintiff Petitioner.
May it please the court, Christine Liberelli, on behalf of the Public Employment Relations Commission.
May it please the court, Your Honor, Matthew Armin from the law firm of Markowitz in Richmond. I represent the amicus party, New Jersey State Lodge of the Fraternal Order of Police.
May it please the court, Tim Sheehan on behalf of Amicus Curiae, the Attorney General of New Jersey.
Good morning, may it please the court, Leonard Spinelli, Genova Burns on behalf of NJIT.
The court, James Lydon, McElroy, Deutsch, Mulvaney, and Carpenter for Amicus Curiae, Rutgers State University of New Jersey.
No. Welcome, counsel. Two preliminary things. Justice Solomon will be participating. I thank the parties for agreeing to allow him to participate. He will be reviewing the argument. And with overlapping arguments and an abundance of counsel today, I invite you to incorporate arguments that have been made before you stand up to the extent that makes sense. Mr. Forsman, please go ahead.
Thank you. Good morning, Justices. I'm aware everyone is thoroughly familiar with the facts that have been presented, so I will try to keep my statements here short and concise. More than happy to address whatever questions or concerns you guys may have in connection with that. By way of plaintiff petitioner certification, we're asking this honorable court to reverse the appellate division's conclusion that law enforcement officers that are enrolled pursuant to 18A, otherwise known as university, officers are eligible to request special disciplinary arbitration under NJSA 40A-14-200 in sequence, specifically here 209 and 210. As the legislative intent and reasonable interpretation of the statutes from the Public Employment Relations Commission, who are charged with that task, are sufficient to that end. More simply stated, Justices, the appellate division erred in limiting NJSA 40A-14-200 and the following, barring 18A law enforcement officers from utilizing special arbitration under specifically 209 and 210 from that provision. In sum, we are seeking, first, that Officer DiGuglielmo should be permitted to proceed to special disciplinary arbitration under the aforementioned provisions, and additionally, permitting Officer DiGuglielmo to avail himself of his due process rights under the Loudermilk case. I'd like to turn everyone's attention to the 40A-14-200, and when reviewing the expansiveness of that statute, and specifically the definitions section, the appellate division should have adhered to the broadening statutory scheme, which was essentially sought to parallel the rights from non-civil service officers to those of civil service officers. The legislature saw a disparity in the process and the appeals process between these two groups of law enforcement officers and wanted to make sure and tried to procure even footing for both subsects. That can be seen, the extensive scope laid out in the definition section. The appellate division went through at length what a law enforcement agency was. Largely, I think they got that aspect of the case right. You're dealing with a public agency. You are dealing with a police force. And they are empowered by statute to utilize those traditional police powers. There is really no meaningful distinction when you're looking at the officers or the university officers between the laws that they have to enforce versus a civil service officer or a chief's test jurisdiction or a municipal cop for that matter. They can go outside really of their jurisdictional base, which would have been the institution, to effectuate and uphold the laws of New Jersey. So when you're considering all of those facts, you really are looking at the expansive nature of that. So the same broad brush approach should be also applied to the actual law enforcement officer definition as well. When reviewing the definition, all right, it also appears to take this broad sweeping approach, which is substantially larger than what you would find under the NJSA 14-150. The intent of the legislature when reviewing that statute seems to be a more encompassing approach to include more agencies as opposed to exclude more agencies. Now, here in this particular case, the special arbitration was filed under 40A14-210, right? And I think that the court would be inclined to agree that when reviewing the statute, you would also need to take a look at 209, since there are references going back and forth. However, when you look at the actual start of 40A14-210, the very first words, I think, of are paramount importance. It references in lieu of serving, okay? That definition, when they go on to then say, you know, written notice to the Superior Court under the provisions of NJSA 40A14-150, what they're actually saying there, or I would, suggest the justices consider that they were saying there, that it's limiting what was actually required under 150. It's not just saying instead of serving written notice to the Superior Court, it's also referencing the provisions as required in 150, meaning the certain elements which would require they be a municipal officer or they be tried and convicted, and anything that flows along that basis. And the reason being is that same statute under 210 goes on to talk about what is required to file under that particular statute. And it is also inclusive of the limitation of criminal offense. It gets to be a little redundant, because now in all three of these statutes, it references this criminal offense component as a limiting factor. But here, when reviewing 210, that appears to be the only one other than the specific time limitations that the legislature put into that particular statute. So when looking at the totality of those three statutes, I believe the only reasonable interpretation would be, when considering 210, to look at it at a standalone in terms of the filing process and how to achieve special arbitration, coupled with the definition section, justices, where the legislature was trying to take this more inclusive approach, not limiting people. As you justices saw in the briefs initially, the Juvenile Justice Commission was supposed to be excluded as one of those departments. So the legislature did take independent steps to limit the scope to a certain degree, and they easily could have included 18A officers in that interpretation or their analysis of the same. Their intention was not to do that and to give a broad brush approach and make these officers on equal footing with those of civil service officers and have this de novo appeal right of review. So in conclusion, justices, the only truly rational decision that can be made is that Officer DeGuglielmo and similarly situated law enforcement officers, specifically those 18A officers, potentially even to the point where maybe certain sheriff's officers that are not within the civil service jurisdiction that are to uphold the laws of the state of New Jersey, should be entitled to the same process, the same disciplinary procedures as the other officers, and specifically here, entitle them to go through with special disciplinary arbitration as contemplated by the statute and as interpreted by the by PERC.
Would you like to address the suspension without pay question, or do you want to defer to PERC for that?
In regards to Loudermill, I can briefly address that, but I would also allow the amicus to speak as well. But essentially, in regards to Loudermill, what happened ultimately here is Officer DeGuglielmo was entitled to as the department put it, a due process meeting. Was not afforded any ability to have or review any discovery prior to this meeting. Essentially, what happens at these meetings is they go in, here is the preliminary notice, or at least our proposed preliminary notice of disciplinary charges. What do you have to say about that? Under Loudermill, I would view that as being insufficient. Because at the bare minimum, what you get under Loudermill or your pre-termination hearing is you have a right to see the charges and at least a statement of the evidence that will be used against you. Here, I just say those rights were completely abrogated and weeded out. And summarily, after the fact, since he decided not to participate in that proceeding, that kind of put the end to that process.
The appellate division said being suspended without pay is essentially a prerequisite mm-hmm. to special arbitration. Do you want to address that point or leave that?
Sure. No, I can address that as well. So when reviewing these three statutes, as I stated previously, I do think that they should be viewed at as separate entities. Otherwise, there really would have only been a need to develop one, for example, 40A14209, as opposed to drafting 209 and 210. I think it's important to take a look at when you're reviewing 210 that it once again does explicitly reference the fact that it's not applicable to any parties that have that criminal charge component to filing for special arbitration. If you look at each one of those statutes, 150, 209, 210, that appears in every single one of them. So it stands to reason that since that limitation is put in there, they easily could have also put in the limitations to require to be suspended without pay to be eligible for it, and the legislature just did not do that. So strictly looking at 210, I would say that the intent of that statute was to open it up a more broad scope and not limit it to those that were only suspended without pay, Justice.
So do you draw a distinction between individuals who are suspended without pay and those who are terminated with respect to the two statutes?
It's an interesting question, Justice. In my opinion, they're really tantamount to the same thing in terms of the individual, because the way it plays out in this process, at least with this due process meeting, you're afforded a very short duration of time in which you'd actually effectively be able to be suspended without pay. Because when this due process meeting ultimately occurs, then you are going to be shortly thereafter terminated. And the appellate rights that you would get under their contract would be to pursue it through the contract, but you're already terminated. So you're not getting an actual hearing as contemplated potentially by the Attorney General guidelines or anything like that either under this process. But for intents and purposes under the statutes, I would say that there is a difference, and that's the reason that 209 was drafted and the reason that 210 was drafted. I believe the legislature would have just kind of broad swept this under one statute, mainly 209, if the intent was to limit it solely to officers that were suspended without pay.
Questions, anyone? Thank you, Mr. Forsman.
Thank you, Justices.
Ms. Lucarelli.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. FERC has thoughtfully contemplated the special disciplinary statutes since being charged with administering them 12 years ago. One could reasonably argue that these are inartfully constructed statutes. FERC's position is, and has always been, that they require a sensible and practical reading. They also require broad application in line with the applicable definition section and in line with the legislative intent. The legislature explicitly recognized that the disciplinary appeal procedures were well established for civil service jurisdictions, but that there were no standard appeal procedures for non-civil service jurisdictions. Thus, the purpose of the special disciplinary statutes was to provide standard disciplinary appeal procedures for non-civil service jurisdictions. This court has two substantive issues before it. The first is, are university police eligible for special disciplinary arbitration? PERC's answer is yes. This issue was first presented to PERC in 2010 in a case also involving NJIT. In that decision, the commission found that the statutory definitions of law enforcement officer and law enforcement agency were satisfied, and thus university police were eligible for special disciplinary arbitration. NJIT initially appealed PERC's 2010 decision, but then withdrew its appeal. Fast forwarding to this case today,
The full development of the record here and the clear realities here confirm that PERC's 2010 decision was correct, and the appellate division agreed on that aspect of the case. Without access to special disciplinary arbitration, university police would be treated inconsistently from other police by not having an external and expeditious statutory right to disciplinary review. PERC's experience over the last 12 years bears out that since the inception of special disciplinary arbitration, 30% of the applications that PERC has received have been from university police. PERC has confronted the question of whether university police are like other police in different contexts aside from special disciplinary arbitration. 28 years ago, PERC decided that university police were entitled to statutory interest arbitration, just like other police, although they were not specifically included in the statutory definition of public police department. That remains the law today. In another example, 24 years ago, PERC decided that university police, just like other police, are prohibited from arbitrating major discipline pursuant to a collective negotiations agreement. Despite numerous challenges to that decision, that also remains the law today. These practical examples illustrate that, for better or for the worse of university police, PERC's treatment of these officers has been inclusive and consistent with other police in different contexts aside from special disciplinary arbitration. The second substantive issue before this court is, must an officer be suspended without pay to qualify for special disciplinary arbitration? PERC's answer is no. PERC has interpreted 209A and 210A as providing two distinct avenues of review of non-criminal charges. PERC's view is that 209A applies to an officer who is suspended without pay for whom termination is being sought, and 210 applies to an officer who is plainly terminated, irrespective of prior status. The officer could have been suspended with pay or summarily terminated. 210A is an entirely separate section from 209A. The legislature saw fit to include 210A in these statutes, and it plainly requires that an officer be terminated with no other qualifying language. PERC's view on the suspension status issue makes practical sense and considers both the language of the statute and the legislative intent to provide standardized disciplinary appeal procedures for non-civil service officers. And putting the suspension status issue in a real-life context for this court, for the last 12 years, PERC has not received an application for special disciplinary arbitration from an officer who was suspended without pay. Said another way, every application has been filed by an officer who was suspended with pay and then terminated. Next, I turn to the statutory language in 209 and 210, which refer back to 48:14-150 and was focused on by the appellate division to find that special disciplinary arbitration was designed to apply to municipal officers only. PERC does not share the restrictive view of the appellate division on this issue.
Can I ask you to go back to for a moment?
Sure.
To the distinction drawn between officers suspended without pay and those terminated. Is there a third category that could result in special arbitration? An officer suspended with pay?
An officer suspended with pay would qualify for non-criminal charges, obviously, would qualify under 210A. With pay and then terminated. You must be terminated.
But that's the question.
Okay.
Is there yet another category? Because I want to make sure that the way that we interpret the statute encompasses the various possibilities. Or is this simply not a possibility given the way the process unfolds? Can you be suspended with pay and have the ability to seek special arbitration?
No, not under the view and the approach that PERC has taken.
But one can be suspended with pay.
With pay, but you must ultimately be terminated. Because the language in 210A refers to an officer who was terminated.
To get to special arbitration.
Correct.
Is there another, what means does an officer suspended with pay have to challenge that suspension?
Prior to being terminated?
Yes.
I'm not sure, but it wouldn't be through special disciplinary arbitration.
Are you familiar with officers suspended with pay seeking to challenge? Does that happen?
It doesn't happen at PERC. We don't see that at PERC because we are charged with administering these statutes. And again, these statutes cover 209A, officers suspended without pay, 210A, officers who are terminated irrespective of their prior status.
Thank you.
So you mentioned earlier that the applications you've the majority of the applications or all the applications you've received in the past, I can't remember number of years, have been officers who were suspended without pay but then eventually terminated? Is that what?
Actually, it's the reverse of that. All the applications received in the last 12 years have been officers suspended with pay
right. And
then terminated and therefore processed under 210A.
So there's no applications being made in the interim between suspension with pay and termination?
That is correct, yes.
And your position is that that is not allowed under the statute?
Correct, yes.
Please go ahead.
Okay. Next, I turn to the statutory language in 209 and 210, which refer back to 150 and was focused on by the appellate division to find that special disciplinary arbitration was designed to apply to municipal officers only. PERC does not share the restrictive view of the appellate division on this issue. PERC's view is that the language referring back to 150 illustrates that non-civil service municipal officers have two avenues of appeal, through 150 and through special disciplinary arbitration, while non-civil service non-municipal officers, like university police, have only one avenue of appeal, through special disciplinary arbitration. This view is in line, again, with the legislative intent to provide standardized disciplinary appeal procedures for non-civil service officers.
Do you agree there's no ambiguity in 150 in the definition or the phrase a police department or force in a municipality? Does that clearly refer only to municipal officers?
Yes.
Or are you suggesting otherwise?
No, PERC's view is that 150 does clearly apply to municipal officers.
You're saying that 150's application in 209 and 210 is limited to the notice provisions in 150?
Right. So, again, yes, it just clearly, the references back give two avenues of appeal for municipal officers, non-civil service municipal officers, and one avenue of appeal for non-civil service non-municipal officers. That's what the purpose of that language is, and that's what PERC's view has been. And again, this is in line with the legislative intent. Finally, I want to address the Attorney General's arguments that special disciplinary arbitration must be expressly bargained for in the collective negotiations agreement. PERC does not share that view with the Attorney General. This court's decision in State v. State Supervisory Employees Association clearly held that all statutes and regulations are to be read into collective negotiations agreements as if they are part of the agreement. Thus, an individual could not be stripped of his or her statutory right to special disciplinary arbitration. Moreover, an officer cannot be precluded from special disciplinary arbitration by not exhausting the grievance procedure in the agreement. And I will again note that university police cannot arbitrate major discipline pursuant to a collective negotiations agreement. The legislature created no procedural prerequisite to special disciplinary arbitration other than that an application must be filed within 20 days. However, to the extent that an employer wants to raise an argument of failure to exhaust the grievance procedure, it could certainly raise that argument to the arbitrator as a matter of procedural arbitrability. Finally, PERC's view and application of these statutes over the last 12 years should be afforded deference. The legislature deemed it appropriate to charge PERC with administering these statutes. It's inconsequential that they don't appear in the New Jersey Employer-Employee Relations Act. PERC's view is practical and sensible, and it's not contrary to the statutory language. And furthermore, it is supported by the clear legislative intent for these statutes.
Thank you, Mr. Nicarelli. Mr. Armin.
Good morning, Justices. In my brief time, I will heed the advice of Chief Justice Ravner and limit my discussion to matters that were not fully argued by Mr. Forsman and Ms. Lucarelli. Suffice to say, however, that the FOP does agree with the arguments made on behalf of Officer DeGuglielmo and on behalf of PERC regarding the applicability of the statute to Officer DeGuglielmo and similarly college and public college and university law enforcement officers, as well as the discussion about the failure of the appellate division to afford adequate deference to the interpretation made by PERC of the statute in which it was tasked to interpret. With that, I would like to touch on two points that were briefly discussed, and hopefully, Justice Ravner, I can touch on a question that you raised earlier. The two issues have to do with the reference relied upon by the appellate division to Section 150, and what the appellate division obviously decided was that because there's a reference to 150, which as pointed out, does only apply to municipal police officers or law enforcement officers, that means that Section 209 and 210 should also only apply to municipal police officers. That simply is an erroneous conclusion under the statute. You have to start with the principle set forth not only in the legislation itself, but also in the legislative history, that the intent of the legislature in passing this statute was to have a broad application to create a system of adjudication and review for non-civil service police and firefighters. By limiting this application of the process only to municipal police officers, the appellate division carves out an entire population of non-municipal police and fire who would otherwise be covered by the statute. And the definitions set forth in Section 200 clearly articulate that there should be an expansive application of this process and the availability of the process to municipal, county, and state police and firefighters. Now, the appellate division suggested that its view of 150 squared with the statute because the state and county police and firefighters would already be covered by civil service. Unfortunately, that is not the case. There are county, at the very least, county entities, in particular Somerset County, that does not belong to civil service and does employ law enforcement personnel, corrections officers, and perhaps others. So by interpreting it the way it did, the appellate division would carve out individuals who are clearly meant to be able to abide the process if they so choose.
If the appellate division was right about that, what do those types of employees do in that situation?
Well, there would be a very good question as to what their recourse might be because they don't fall under 150, right? So I think we'd probably, before too long, be in front of the justices again litigating what their right to recourse might be. That is exactly what the legislature meant to rectify. And as Ms. Lucarelli argued, I think a more reasonable interpretation is that the reference to 150 was to suggest that
For municipal officers, the rights set forth in 150 still exist. However, there is also this added right in the event of a termination, and I'm going to get to the question that Chief Justice Ravner raised. In the event of a termination, there becomes a second avenue for municipal police officers, and for which is special disciplinary arbitration, and for county or state non-civil service, non-criminally related terminations, county and or non-municipal police and fire would only have the right to special disciplinary arbitration in the event of a termination. And that brings me to answer the question that was raised earlier. Termination is, as a representative of the FOP, I would love to have all discipline be subject to special disciplinary arbitration, but that is simply not the case. The legislature said or set termination as the triggering factor for the availability of the special disciplinary process. The other aspect that the appellate division, I think, erred on is this notion of requiring an officer or a firefighter to have been suspended without pay before they can take advantage of special disciplinary arbitration. This creates an exception that swallows the rule. As you've heard, the applications for the past 12 years would not fall under this narrow view and would essentially exclude the beneficiaries of this legislation from being able to take advantage of special disciplinary arbitration. To focus a little more deeply on Section 209, essentially mirrors Section 201, which covers civil service. And the intent there, I would suggest, is to address the length of time an officer or firefighter can be suspended without pay before they have to start getting pay again while their case is being adjudicated. It is an effort to limit the damage to an officer or firefighter who may be suspended without pay and may have to wait more than 180 days to have their case adjudicated. That is the focus of 209, similarly of 201 in the civil service realm.
So when you said earlier that termination is the trigger, is suspension without pay a separate trigger?
If an individual, firefighter, police officer, is suspended without pay, typically, let's say for some alleged infraction, they're suspended for 10 days without pay. They may not avail themselves of special disciplinary arbitration because it's only a 10-day suspension. They have not been terminated. If, on the other hand, they are suspended without pay for 179 days, and there's no intent to terminate, they may not trigger special disciplinary arbitration, in my view.
They may not. Challenge the suspension without pay through special arbitration.
Correct. Unless they are being terminated. Now, once it gets to 180 days, the suspension lasts 180 days, under the statute, they are required to, the employer is required to commence their pay again, because you cannot be suspended without pay for more than 180 days. What I would also suggest, Chief Justice, is under that scenario where someone is simply suspended indefinitely, there may be other course of action, whether that's an action in lieu of prerogative writs or something under the collective bargaining agreement. But special disciplinary arbitration is only triggered, again, I would like it to be broader, but it's only triggered by termination. So under these,
so you part company from PERC on that interpretation, or
I think we have the same interpretation that that termination is the trigger for special disciplinary arbitration. It could happen with a suspension without pay, in which case the employer would have to start paying after the 180th day, or it could happen if somebody is suspended with or without pay for a week and then is terminated. They would have to be, then they would fall under 210.
I'm going to ask Ms. Lucarelli to stand up afterwards and tell me if she has the same view, because in reading Perk's brief, I thought, and I may have misread it, that they interpreted 209 to refer to officers suspended without pay as distinct from 210, which applies directly to terminated police officers, and I'm quoting from page 9. You're saying under both, termination is required in order to get special arbitration.
I am saying under both, termination is required to get to special arbitration.
Which then begs the question, what's the difference between 209 and 210?
Because 209 talks about someone who's suspended without pay for an extended period of time and mirrors the civil service requirement.
But that's in Section B. Section A sets forth the right to seek special arbitration, and it doesn't impose that condition. If I understood the statute correctly, and please tell me otherwise.
So
B says if it takes too long for the arbitration proceeding to reach a final determination, beyond 180 days, you're going to get your payback.
That's right.
That doesn't necessarily, or does it, mean that termination is the trigger?
In A, it talks about suspended from performing official duties without pay for complaint or charges other than criminally related infraction. And then if you look, so that talks about the suspension without pay. And then it continues to talk about the 180-day requirement. In 210A, it simply talks about termination. So in my view, in both instances, termination is the trigger, but the 209 talks about what happens when someone is suspended for a lengthy period without pay.
But wasn't one of the goals of this amendment to provide some relief for those officers who have been suspended for an extended period of time before a decision has been made in their proceedings? So similar to the Chief Justice's line of questioning, it doesn't seem to square with either the meaning in 210 or the legislative purpose behind 209 to provide some relief to these officers that are going an extended period of time without pay.
Justice, that is a fair interpretation, and in reading the 209, to the extent the court would extend that availability to officers who are suspended sort of indefinitely without pay, we would, you know, certainly the FOP would encourage that interpretation and afford it to an even broader class of employees other than those who are terminated. But if I'm being fair here, the way I read the statute is that termination is the trigger under both sections.
One additional question.
Sure.
Individuals suspended with pay obviously have a different set of incentives and may not seek review during that interim period. Is there an avenue of relief for them nonetheless, for the few who might seek review?
Yeah, arguably an individual under those circumstances could file a grievance because if they are suspended with pay, there may be an avenue under the collective negotiations agreement to pursue that.
But not the statutory scheme.
If they are suspended with pay and ultimately terminated, yes, they would be covered under 210.
But if you're just suspended with pay, you're not terminated.
I do not think the statute applies.
Thank you. Other questions? Anything you'd like to add?
No, thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you. Mr. Sheehan. Got to ask Ms. Lucarelli. We'll come to you after Mr. Sheehan.
May it please the court. The Attorney General has a narrow interest in this case. The language in Section 200's definitions for law enforcement agency and law enforcement officer are used in other statutes that establish the scope of the Attorney General's oversight of all law enforcement officers. And the narrow construction of that language in Section 200 that's urged by NJIT and Rutgers creates potential problems for how far that same language reaches when used in those other statutes setting forth that oversight authority. NJIT's construction in particular is also wrong as a matter of statutory interpretation, because the capacious definitions of agency and officer in Section 200 do sweep in campus police officers like petitioner. So while we take no view on what the ultimate result should be in petitioner's case, I'd like to just briefly walk through how we construe the definitions of law enforcement agency and officer in Section 200. The defined term law enforcement agency is incorporated within the officer definition, so I'll start with the agency definition. I think the key language here is any public agency other than the Department of Law and Public Safety within the state. I think it's straightforward that NJIT comes within the ambit of that language, because NJIT is any public agency and it's within the state. It's already treated as a state agency for purposes of immunity under the Tort Claims Act and for purposes of the Administrative Procedure Act. That comes from the Benitez case that was cited by the Appellate Division, and the APA treatment comes from Title 18A:64E-18I. NJIT has focused on its status as an in but not of agency, which it thinks changes the analysis. But its status as an in but not of just confirms that it's a state agency. As this court knows, there are numerous examples of in but not of agencies throughout state government, and those are by definition state agencies. So in the same way that the Cannabis Regulatory Commission or Office of Public Defender, which are in but not of the Department of Treasury, are state agencies, so too is NJIT. Turning to a law enforcement officer, that similar reference to state, county, or municipal law enforcement or department or division of thereof also appears in that definition. So we start from the premise that state, county, municipal language is doing the same work in both definitions. So this isn't a separate analysis when you get to law enforcement officer. Once you establish that a campus police department like NJIT's police force is a law enforcement agency, that similar language in the officer definition is not some further limitation, because that language is qualifying the defined term law enforcement agency within the officer definition. Otherwise, you could have a result where a campus police department is a law enforcement agency, but its police officers are not law enforcement officers. But even if the court thinks that the reference to state, county, municipal is some further limitation within the officer definition, NJIT's police department still fits the bill, because here again the language is it sweeps in an officer employed by any state, county, or municipal law enforcement agency or department or division of those programs. As I just explained, NJIT is the state for purposes of these definitions, and its police department is a department or division of that level of government. So we think the statutory interpretation is pretty straightforward with respect to both definitions, but the Attorney General also has a concern about what the potential downstream consequences of this more strained reading are, because this reference to state, county, and municipal law enforcement is used in other statutes, some of which implicate the scope of the Attorney General's supervisory responsibility. I think the best example of this is the recently enacted statute that generally requires law enforcement to wear body-worn cameras. This is Title 40A, 14-118.3. This statute requires, quote, every uniformed state, county, and municipal patrol law enforcement officer to generally wear a body-worn camera. And there are two attorney general directives implementing that statute. Both the statute and the AG directives are silent with respect to campus police departments. But everyone understands that that still sweeps in campus police, and that's why campus police departments across the state, including NJIT and Rutgers, have complied with that statute and with the directives. But under NJIT's view that the language state, county, municipal somehow excludes campus police departments, that statute would categorically exempt all campus police officers, which again is not how this has been implemented. It's not how the Attorney General or institutions of higher ed across the state understand that language.
We understand the argument, Mr. Sheen.
Thank you. So our office doesn't take any view on the other issues in the case or what the ultimate holding would be. We just ask that the court, in reaching that holding, affirm that campus police officers are law enforcement officers within the meaning of the statute.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Ms. Lucarelli?
Yes.
Is there daylight between your position and the FOP's with respect to termination being the trigger for both 209 and 210?
So under 209A, PERC's position has been that it is applicable to an officer who is suspended without pay where termination is being sought, but who may or may not be actually terminated at the time that they apply for special disciplinary arbitration. Whereas 210A is applicable to an officer who is terminated irrespective of his or her prior suspension status.
So it's PERC's position that if an officer is suspended without pay, they can seek special disciplinary arbitration, notwithstanding having been, so termination in that instance is not the trigger from PERC's perspective.
Yes.
So your view does differ.
Yes.
Okay.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Mr.
Justice, Mayor?
Yes. Thank you. Mr. Armin, come on back.
I'm sorry. Perhaps I was inarticulate in my statement. For 209, that when I said termination is the trigger, I meant seeking termination is the trigger. So an officer who is simply suspended without pay would not be able to avail him or herself.
Thank you.
But seeking termination is the trigger. Ultimately in 210, termination itself is the trigger.
Thank you. Mr. Spinelli.
Good morning, Justices, and may it please the Court. On its face, the question certified in this matter is a fairly simple question. Are public university officers eligible for special disciplinary arbitration? Our position is that the appellate division correctly concluded that they are not. The panel's analysis was sound and was based upon two key factors. First, SDA, as I'll refer to it, is a remedy available as an alternative to the relief afforded under NJSA 48:14-150. It is limited to municipal officers. And second, the officer in this case was not suspended without pay pending a hearing. He was placed upon administrative leave with pay until his termination was final pursuant to the terms of his collective bargaining agreement. Therefore, Officer DiGuglielmo's only recourse was to pursue the grievance procedures under the collective bargaining agreement. He is not a municipal officer entitled to superior court review pursuant to NJSA 150. He was therefore not entitled to SDA as an alternative. And he was not suspended without pay pending a final determination of his termination. Below, the appellate panel focused on the language in 209 and 210, which provides SDA as an alternative remedy to superior court review under 150. It focused on the legislative history of 150, and the court recognized that in its recodification, it was still only applicable to municipal officers, and when it was amended in 2009 along with this package of amendments, it was not amended to include non-municipal officers. But we can take this analysis a step further, and it further complicates the application of SDA to non-municipal officers. In the case of Roroa Day versus Hasbrook Heist in 2013, this court well summarize the disciplinary procedures as it applies to municipal officers. And I'll borrow that language from the court because I think it shines a light on the purpose and intent of SDA. And I also think it shines a light on the implications of applying SDA to non-municipal officers. According to the plain language of the statutory scheme under review, a municipal officer cannot be suspended, removed, fined, or reduced in rank without just cause. That is a statutory application. It is a statutory requirement, and it's codified in 40A 14-147. That is still only applicable to municipal officers. An officer cannot be removed for political reasons or for any other cause other than incapacity, misconduct, or disobedience of rules and regulations. As such, a police department has the burden of filing a written complaint setting forth the charge or charges against him, and an officer is entitled to a hearing on the charges, but may waive the right to a hearing and may appeal the charges directly to any available authority specified by law or regulation. Prior to a hearing, an officer may be suspended from his position with or without pay. That's in sections 149 and 149.1 of that same statute. Additionally, when an officer is suspended, a hearing on the charges must be commenced within 30 days from the date of service of the complaint. If the charges are upheld at that disciplinary hearing, the officer has the remedy of pursuing superior court review under section 150. None of these provisions are applicable to non-municipal university officers. And so the framework under which SDA was contemplated, particularly suspensions without pay, as it's contemplated in 149 and 149.1, and the standard of review at the SDA level contemplated in section 147, are all statutes that are specifically applicable to municipal officers. And the legislature has not made any amendments to those statutes that would suggest that the review in 150 and the supporting statutes is in any way applicable to the officers at issue here. And so what the unions and what PERC is essentially asking this court to do is to rewrite 147, 148, 149, 149.1, and 150 to apply it to non-municipal officers, which has never been done. We can argue all day that it may have been the intent, but the fact of the matter is that without those core principles informing SDA, there's no way of properly applying the SDA review to a non-municipal officer because those fundamental principles are currently not in place for those officers. And that's reflected in the fact that PERC's own guidelines state two very crucial things. NJAC 19:12-6.1, defining special disciplinary arbitration. Review through binding arbitration is an alternative to review through a proceeding in the Superior Court of New Jersey pursuant to 150. And then in section 6.7D, they say, that hearing shall be de novo proceedings and shall not be limited to review of any proceedings or hearings held in order to impose discipline in accordance with NJSA 40A:14-147. That is strictly a municipal statute at this time. So how can SDA impose a standard of review upon officers that doesn't apply to them? That's the challenge that we face, and that was the recognition that Judge Sabatino issued in his decision, and why, as it's currently drafted, special disciplinary arbitration cannot be incorporated for non-municipal officers.
Is NJIT a public agency?
I don't think we could disagree that NJIT is a public agency. As the Attorney General pointed out, they are in but not of the Department of State. They're organized by statute. They're a body corporate and politic.
As a public agency, it qualifies as within the definition of law enforcement agency.
I would disagree with that distinction, and here's why.
I was just looking at the definitional language at the beginning of 200.
Yeah, so if you look at the definitional language, it is a state agency that is independently authorized by statute to conduct law enforcement activities. And I think the distinction that we draw between NJIT and other police departments, such as municipal police departments, is that NJIT, its primary purpose, as defined by statute, is as a public university. Its primary purpose is to provide educational faculties.
What meaning does any public agency have in the definitional section? How does it apply?
Any public agency in the definitional section.
You've told us, look at firefighters, look at police officers in municipal non-civil service towns. The definitional section uses a broader phrase. The very first phrase is any public agency. What meaning does that have under your understanding of the statutes?
Well, I think if we read the definitional statute, I think any public agency would include NJ Transit. But there is a lot of subsequent clauses in there. And I think if you read the statute, we focus on the any public agency language. There's a modifier. And essentially, the statute has to be read in this context as any public agency which is empowered by statute to act for the detection, investigation, arrest, conviction, detention, or rehabilitation of persons violating the criminal laws of the state. Our position is essentially that although NJIT may hire officers for the purposes of patrolling its campus and contiguous areas, that the agency itself is not independently authorized by statute to perform those activities. It has to hire officers. Those officers are law enforcement officers. We would not disagree with that interpretation. Where I think we differ is that law enforcement officers is not the only requisite to SDA. What it is a law enforcement officer employed by a law enforcement agency. NJIT is not a law enforcement agency to the extent that it is not independently empowered to perform these law enforcement activities by statute. Their statutory charge is as an educational institution. So, to get to the distinction between 209 and 210 and whether or not it is a prerequisite to special disciplinary arbitration that the officer be suspended without pay before being eligible for review under SDA, it's NJIT's position that there is only one avenue under SDA to pursue that remedy, and that is when the officer is specifically suspended without pay pending a hearing. And I'll refer back to the municipal code that talks about there being a hearing contemplated and that the officer may be suspended with or without pay.
The officer in this case,
yes,
was terminated before filing with PERC.
Correct.
Why not look to Section 210, which on the face of it addresses officers who've been terminated?
So I think 210 has to be read in context of 209. As I view the statute, 209 is the authorizing statute that authorizes this expedited review through the special disciplinary arbitration procedures that allows an officer to proceed under this statute. When we look at 210, it specifically references 209 as being the enabling statute. So as I read the two statutes in conjunction, I read 209 as being the authority of the officer to file and it being an express condition that the officer be suspended without pay. When you go to 210, 210 is the procedural mechanism, but it specifically says, in lieu of serving a written notice, an officer seeking review of the termination of his employment, as prescribed in subsection 209. So it refers back onto 209 as the enabling statute authorizing review. And in fact, when you look at the amendment to 150, again, the alternative review to 150 is not an alternative review under 210. It's an alternative review under 209, which again carries with it the prerequisite that officers be suspended without pay. And that's important because the review under Superior Court review contemplates that the officer has been terminated. Once the officer is terminated, he has the right to review that under 150. As an alternative, he can go to Section 209. But ultimately, 209 requires that the officer be suspended without pay.
So what do you make of Section 209C that talks about officers who were receiving full pay pending their final determination? Could the reference in 210 to 209 be related to that particular section? Because that section is clearly discussing officers or firefighters who were suspended with pay. Correct?
It does contemplate officers who are receiving full pay pending a final determination in accordance with the provisions of subsection A of the section. However, again, section 209 contemplates that an officer will continue to receive full pay after 180 days. And subsection C directly follows that contemplation that after 180 days, the officer will again be receiving full pay. So I think subsection C is actually referring to the officer whose suspension without pay has ended by the 180 day cutoff and now again begins receiving full pay. I don't think that it contemplates that an officer would be receiving full pay prior to that 180-day bar.
Mr. Spinelli, can we go back to 210A for a moment?
Yes.
If I understood your answer, you're saying look at the statute and read essentially this to mean in lieu of written notice, an individual as appropriate can proceed as prescribed in 209. Is that fair?
That's fair.
So in so reading the statute, you've left out, or have you, the phrase seeking review of the termination of employment. What's left of that?
So I think it still refers back to 209 because 209 specifically contemplates that there is a termination pending. So the purpose of 209 is not to review the suspension without pay. It's to review the contemplated termination.
Here we're dealing with a different situation. It's not contemplated termination. It's termination, as in the case of your client who's seeking review. Why doesn't 210 cover that in light of the specific phrase in the second clause of the statute?
So I think it goes back to the questions and the distinction and the clarity that the Chief, Your Honor, was seeking. From the unions about the distinction between when an officer is triggered review, theoretically, if there were two proposed statutes or two proposed avenues. In order for an officer to proceed under 209, as PERC argues, they would have to be notified of a suspension without pay and then notified that they were being suspended without pay pending a termination, okay? And then in 210, it's simply triggered upon the termination. What I would argue is that this language in 210 is essentially referring to the termination that's being contemplated pending the suspension. Because ultimately, in either case, what's being reviewed by the arbitration panel is the decision to terminate, not whether the suspension. So the termination is being under review when there is a suspension without pay. That is essentially what that is referring to. I don't think it creates a separate avenue to review any termination. Those avenues are confined to either the contract or confined to 150. But this idea that from a construction perspective, it doesn't seem to make logical sense that you would put the bar of suspension without pay pending termination and then go on to codify the procedures, but refer back to the same gateway statute in 209 that puts those implications in play.
The first advocate pointed out this may not be the most ideally crafted set of statutes. Do you agree with that?
I would agree, and I would agree for this particular reason, and it's the reason I started my argument with Chief Justice. In order for us to interpret SDA to apply to non-municipal officers at this juncture, we would need to go back and rewrite all of the municipal statutes, because ultimately SDA is applying a standard, a statutory standard of just cause, to officers that don't have that statutory implications upon them because they're non-municipal officers. So it begs the question, what standard are we applying? According to PERC, it's still 147. But 147 doesn't apply to NJIT's officers. There is a contractual provision, but now are we going to rewrite SDA and PERC's regulation to tell them to review the contract? There are errors and omissions, and there are certainly conflations in this statute that render this a very difficult exercise. I would agree with that wholeheartedly. But I think that ultimately, we can only review the statute the way it was crafted, apply it based upon its plain terms and meaning. And if the legislature takes a different approach or believes that that was incorrect, then they have the power to amend it. And in fact, there is a bill pending to amend 150 that was introduced in December of 2020 that has not even left committee. So the legislature could have rendered this issue moot, but has not done so. I think it's worth at least taking the judicial notice that if the legislature wants to correct the inefficiencies in the statute and correct the clarity, then perhaps they're best positioned to do so, because even that proposed legislation, in my opinion, doesn't fix the problem of 147 has still not been amended to apply to non-municipal officers, and 147 is the standard that PERC is using in SDA arbitration. How can we reconcile the two without amending the entire municipal codification scheme to now apply to municipal officers, which simply hasn't been done?
Practically speaking, how is an entity like NJIT harmed by this court adopting PERC's interpretation of these statutes?
Practically speaking, I think it renders NJIT subject, or it reduces its capacity to control the officers that it employs. And I think this situation is a perfect example. I specifically chose not to get into the facts of the case because I don't think they are particularly relevant. But in this circumstance, and in response to your question, I think it's worth raising. The officer in question was patrolling the Newark area surrounding NJIT. He suspected a young bicyclist, African-American, of engaging in a Title 39 traffic violation. He was training a probationary officer. He chased that officer down the wrong way of a one-way street without his lights on, screamed profanities at the youth. He tackled him, shackled him, and then the youth needed medical attention. On top of that, it was recorded by bystanders, and it created a PR problem. So ultimately, NJIT's interest in this is that, look, we have an interest in controlling and responding to these types of matters. We have a robust and comprehensive disciplinary review procedure in our collective bargaining agreements. The officer had a due process meeting that complied with Loudermill. And to address my colleague's point on that issue briefly, Loudermill really merely requires that the officer be presented with the charges against him, an explanation of the evidence, and an opportunity to be heard. He chose not to go forward with that. At that point, his termination was final. And he had remedial avenues available to him. And he had an ability for a full-blown hearing. He had ability to obtain discovery. He had ability to raise that to the Board of Trustees if he was unhappy with the outcome of the hearing. And then from the Board of Trustees, he had a right of appellate review under the Administrative Procedures Act. So our interest is ensuring that we have the ability to respond to these types of issues and determine and make the managerial prerogative determination of when and how our officers can and should not continue in our employ.
You've heard the Attorney General's argument.
Yes.
If your position prevails, what governs the use of body cameras and the like?
Yeah. So I think that's a fair question. I think we addressed it in our responding brief, and I may defer to my colleague at Rutgers as well to address some of the issues on the law enforcement agency perspective. But I think that the overall context of the Attorney General guidelines applies to officers. And we do not contend that NJIT's officers are law enforcement officers. They go through the same training. They're empowered by statute to act and to perform law enforcement authority. So we would not contend that a finding that NJIT is not an independently authorized law enforcement agency pursuant to statute, that it would somehow diminish or preclude the Attorney General's oversight of law enforcement officers. And in fact, the Attorney General recognizes that it's not the definition of law enforcement officer that jeopardizes the interpretation. And they say in their brief that they take no position as to whether an NJIT is a law enforcement agency because it doesn't have the same implications. The implication is that NJIT officers are law enforcement officers who are subject to Attorney General oversight. We do not dispute that position. And we don't dispute that NJIT is a public agency. But I think where we differ is as used in 200, which is, in fact, the words that precede the definitions of the statute, in the statute. As used in 200, NJIT is not a law enforcement agency because it is not independently authorized or empowered to engage in police activities. It can hire officers, their primary purpose is for providing higher education and also protecting its students within its contiguous bounds.
Other questions, anyone? Anything you'd like to add?
No, Chief Justice, thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Leiden.
Morning, and may it please the court. The focus that I think has not gotten as much attention as I think is needed is what I'll focus on. If the court has any questions on some of these other issues, I'll be glad to respond. But I really think the key is the recognition that the plain language of a statute is entitled to be applied unless doing so produces some sort of absurd result. And I don't think we're in that ballpark at all. And the plain language that I'm referring to in specific is the definition of law enforcement agency in section 200. And I think, people have hopscotched this issue. Certainly, Mr. Spinelli did not, but I'd like to emphasize the point there. I mean, if you look at the two definitions, there's a parallel. So a law enforcement agency, and putting aside the type of entity, you're dealing with at different levels of government and types of government agency, the only operative piece, once you qualify these entities as falling into the bucket of a public agency, the only operative language left in a law enforcement agency definition is which is empowered by statute to act for the detection, investigation, arrest, conviction, et cetera, to statutory authorization to be a law enforcement agency, to act as one. And, that's something we didn't hear a lot about until Mr. Spinelli stood up. I mean, I think the issue was absolutely hopscotched. They jumped right over it. Where's the statute that gives NJIT authority to operate a law enforcement agency? Where is it? Pelt Division didn't find it. The Attorney General didn't find it. Where is that statutory authority? The surrogate for that, that was supplied below, well, let's not worry about whether the agency has this law enforcement authority. They employ police officers who do. Good enough. I mean, that's basically horseshoes and hand grenades. Good enough. Because there is no statute that says NJIT has law enforcement authority, nor that Rutgers does either. And so right there, we don't have to worry about, 209, 210, we're sitting here, this class of officers, because they're employed by an entity that lacks that authority, their officers are not eligible. And we don't have to worry about, you know, critiques of the effectiveness of the legislature in expressing its intentions. I mean, right here, that's very clear. The contrast, it says, which is empowered? The law enforcement officer part says, who is empowered? So it's clearly, it's not the same authority. The which is the entity, the who is the officer. And there's no such authority. And there's a pretty good, you know, pretty good sources of information for what the legislature does when it wants to authorize a law enforcement agency to engage in law enforcement activity. And I would point to the court to, you know, for county of police, 40A-14-106 and 107, and for municipal police, 40A-14-118. I mean, the legislature, it's an explicit grant of authority to do that. You, county, can establish a police force, and that police force can enforce the criminal laws, including 2C. You know, that's how the legislature does it. If you were to say, well, employing someone who has law enforcement authority, police power, like the officers, if that's enough to qualify you for a law enforcement agency, then isn't the definition of law enforcement officer completely circular? Because what makes, you know, you have to be a law enforcement officer employed by a law enforcement agency. Well, if law enforcement officer, if law enforcement agency just means you employ officers that have police power, then you're eliminating the law enforcement agency qualification or defining it as the employer of law enforcement officers, period, without regard to any entity law enforcement authority. That's the simple, straightforward solution that requires no second guessing of the legislature's purpose and intent. It said expressly that. It's the plain language of the statute. It's not absurd. End of story. I don't think we get to what we think the purposes the legislature had in mind are, because they said what they meant, and that condition isn't met for NJIT, and it's not met for Rutgers. There's no such, I'll use the exact word, empowerment by statute to act as a law enforcement agency. The only legislative authority or authority granted to educational institutions under 18A is to hire someone or to appoint someone to serve as a policeman for the institution. And, you know, if you compare, contrast that with 106, 107, and 118, you know you're talking about a very different thing. You know, they still refer to it as a policeman as opposed to the modern, you know, characterization without regard to gender and, you know, a broader sort of description of the role.
So, this counsel, is, how do you respond to the Attorney General's concern that there are statutes like the body cam statute that refer to state, county, or municipal law enforcement agencies, police forces, that they interpret as including campus police officers and have included campus police officers within their Attorney General directives and other policies that come down from the Attorney General's office?
I mean, the Attorney General's office has nothing to worry about. As Mr. Spinelli,
if we're looking at the statutes, part of his argument was there are statutes that refer specifically to state, county, municipal police forces.
I'll tell you, the only time that concern would be real is if the definition from Section 200 was incorporated into those provisions, which it is not. The statute itself, and Mr. Spinelli mentioned it, I'll repeat it. The first words in L-2009 Chapter 16, you know, after the title and be enacted, is as used in this act. That's the legislature said the scope of application of these definitions is this statute that, you know, 2009 Chapter 16. That's what the legislature said. People use terms imprecisely all the time, and they use them differently in different contexts, and that's going to happen no matter what this court does, but it has nothing to do with this statute. You can't, you know, the power is not, there's no universal adoption of a definition of that term that goes across 14A or 4814. That's certainly not what this does. So if people are, there should be some recognition that for different purposes, different definitions should be applied. And for folks that want to avoid those kinds of, you know, potential misunderstandings, put a definition in there that says, this is who I intend this directive to apply to. You know, certainly, but this definitional provision does not have universal application. Clearly, it's limited to this statute. Concern. I don't think it's addressed by this, and I don't think it would be appropriate for this court to have its decision on the application of this statute, influenced by implications that have nothing to do with this statute.
By statute, do NJIT police officers have the authority that municipal police officers do?
Separately conferred, but very essentially the same. The officers have the authority. The institution has none.
The institution hires officers. The officers, the legislature says, have the full authority that police officers have.
The police officers do.
Why doesn't that do the trick under the definitional section of Section 200?
Because that's not what the legislature said. Legislature says that the entity, the which, is empowered by statute.
So,
and that's really the difference when you separate these buckets, because the municipals, the state police, the county police, there's all statutes that empower them. There's no such thing for educational institutions.
So it has to be, does it have to be the sole purpose?
Does
the agency? Police departments arrest, investigate, detect, and so on. Does the public agency have to have that as its sole purpose?
I mean, that's not what the definition says, so I would say no. But what it has to have is a grant of legislative authority to engage in the, not hire police officers, because there's no dispute that exists, but hiring a police officer and running a law enforcement operation are not the same thing, not even close. And to think that the same objective was contemplated when the means of expressing it are so wildly different between the, you know, you're empowered by statute to hire, to appoint someone to serve as a policeman. That's the extent of the authority that they have. The concept that, you know, if you look at that language, what language we want to cut out to make it fit. So it's only this appointment power is equal to law enforcement power. Detection, investigation, arrest, conviction, not the officer, the entity. They have that authority to do that. There's no expression of it in legislation. All they have is appointment power. And I think, I mean, unless we're going to leave that language on the cutting room floor, we're going to have to recognize that they're different animals.
Understood. Other questions? Thank you, Mr. Lyon.
Thank you
to council for the very fine argument.